This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
5 days in this economy, 6 minutes on this program. Yeah, I think we can get it done. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today. This one's the 18th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, I know geopolitics is sucking up all the oxygen. Threat of a land war in Europe will do that to you. But as I say from time to time on this program, do not sleep on the economic news. So we won't. Jordan Holman's at Bloomberg. Neela Richardson's at ADP. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
So, Jordan, let me start with you. And one of the headline numbers of the week, retail sales up nearly 4% for the month of January. You're the retail reporter. What do you think? Sustainable or is that just a blip?
It's really surprising, honestly, that the retail sales were up that strong.
Never good when the retail reporter is surprised. I'm just saying.
It's a crazy world. So a few things happening. The month of January, we still were in this, you know, holiday spending period, or if you were returning things in the store, mm-hmm. you might pick something else up. So there is some of that hangover still. But also, we still don't know how much of this accounts for prices and higher inflation. It's just how much more people have to spend for what they'll usually get. So when you asked about, like, is it sustainable? I think we just need more time to see like what role higher prices are playing. But when I'm talking to retail chiefs, nobody is saying that they're seeing consumer demand chipping away, you know, despite like inflation. So ideally, right now, this is a strong retail environment. Most retailers' outlooks are strong for this year. And so it just remains to be seen if we can sustain that.
All right, we shall see. So, Neela, let me ask you this. I said yesterday on the program, in fact, I started with it, and to be clear, this was Mitchell Hartman's idea in our morning meeting. I did not come up with it. But you know how I've been saying for a year and a half, 2 years now, the virus is in charge of this economy. And Mitchell pointed out yesterday, you know, maybe the virus isn't anymore. Every wave we get is less and less impactful. Consumers are doing well. Labor market's doing all right. Yes, there's inflation, but maybe we're starting to get back some control. What do you think?
Yes, I wouldn't put a bumper sticker that says that anymore on the back of the car.
That was my marketplace swag idea. Oh, well.
I know. I love that swag, but this is not the one. But I do think that the virus is having less of an impact on the economy. Now, mm-hmm. the virus is still not good for people, let's be clear. Mm-hmm. But for the economy, it's having a less impact. But that doesn't mean it's not impacting behavior. It is. We've all adapted to this virus. We have changed our spending behavior. We have changed our work behavior. Companies have changed what they require from their workforce. These changes are affecting the structure of the economy. And some of these changes are permanent. Some of them are transitory. So the pandemic is still having an effect. It's just not affecting the headline growth numbers as much as it once did.
So, Jordan, riff on that for a bit, right? Because you know, the pandemic affecting the people in the economy is right in your sweet spot. And if corporate retail chiefs are saying, you know, we don't anticipate people are going to change their habits, that kind of doesn't match up.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I think what Neela said was really important. It's not affecting the headline numbers. Yeah. But if you're looking at individuals, take, for example, individual malls. I was looking at some malls in Florida. The foot traffic did go down earlier in January when Omicron was, you know, more mm-hmm. intense. And so, yes, overall, it's not having a dramatic effect. So retailers, instead of having to change, you know, their whole strategy, they can be really focused on regions, which is a skill that they've had to build over the pandemic, as, you know, different regions have had different responses to COVID. But overall, their expectation is, if we can control what we can control, then for the most part, people who can spend will keep spending, and that will help bolster our revenue.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so Neela, let me change gears here. And Jordan's saying control the controllable, basically, is a thing that Jay Powell said to me once, actually, when he was, well, I was asking him about, I don't even remember, it was like 3 years ago, but he said, you know what, the Federal Reserve controls the controllable. He was very intent on sticking to the dual mandate, as he has been in public for years and years. Here's what I want to know, though. Inflation at 7.5%. Large effects on this economy. It's the issue. It's a political issue now for the White House. They're talking about how to deal with it. The Fed has undershot on inflation for years and years and years, and now they're behind the power curve on inflation when it's at 7.5%. Why should we believe in the Fed anymore?
Because they are the institution that is endowed with the singular mission to control inflation. So it's not a private sector solution. It's the Fed. It's their job. Mm-hmm. And they've been doing this job for decades. Their credibility hangs on the fact that they do this job well. So they are committed to controlling the inflation. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be challenging. It certainly is. And they're going to have to do so with an eye towards the labor market, which is still in recovery mode, even though we've seen vast improvements. But they are the superhero in this. They don't have superpowers, though. And their policies tend to hit the economy with a 6-month lag. So this is not a quick fix, but it's one that we can, I think, trust the Fed to keep their eye on and prioritize through the duration of inflation back to more comfortable levels.
Key point there, by the way. I want to make sure everybody doesn't miss that. There's a lag in the Fed's actions and then the market and economic reaction. That's a key point. Jordan, super quick, though, because I do want to touch on the geopolitics of this for a second. I have to point out that for all the pressure the White House is getting and for all the pressure the Fed is getting, it's the companies who are raising the prices that are leading to the inflation.
Yep. Absolutely. Yes. Nobody likes to take credit for raising prices. That's why they use a lot of jargon, such as, you know, price management and whatnot. But which, who knows? But the companies are raising the prices. They were making the argument that they have to pay more for transportation or for raw materials, all of those things. But one of the questions that has come up this week is, if you're a large retailer and you say that you have these great vendor relationships, how much do you actually have to raise prices? Right. Can't you negotiate that? And that, as prices get higher across all types of items, I think that will become more of a conversation. And the spotlight will really be on retailers and CEOs specifically to explain exactly why they're, you know, quote unquote, taking this pricing power. Why are they raising their prices on consumers when ideally they have a lot of scale?
All right. You know what? We're not going to get to Russia. We're out of time and they're yelling at me in my ear, Neela. I'm really sorry. Jordan Holman of Bloomberg, Neela Richardson at ADP. Thanks, you two. We'll see you later.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Bye, everybody. Wall Street today was down, but it was a calm down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaking of retailers, as Jordan was, Walmart reported earnings yesterday. Strong earnings, one might fairly say, with a nod toward the current price environment. Inflated would be a good word there. Walmart's whole thing, of course, is that they are an affordable destination for price-sensitive shoppers. But this really hasn't been a deal hunter's economy lately, right? As we head into a holiday weekend, though, that is traditionally overflowing with sales, what kinds of price cuts might those deal hunters see? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Shopping is complicated lately. Ben Cotton in Lafayette, Indiana, usually looks to price to make decisions about what groceries to buy.
I'd get the Sunday paper, I'd go through the ads and the, you know, clip all the coupons.
But whenever he goes to the store,
there's always one thing on my list where, you know, it's like you spin a wheel and that's what's not there this week.
Two opposing forces are pulling at consumers right now, says Charles Lindsay of the University at Buffalo.
We have inflation, which causes consumers to typically be more price sensitive. But we also have scarcity due to supply chain issues and what have you, which causes consumers to be a little less price sensitive.
Over the holidays, spending was strong, even as retailers offered fewer bargains. But as time goes on, shoppers could increasingly hold out for discounts, says Eric Johnson at Columbia Business School.
Raising prices is seen as okay if you have a business reason for it. Now you're starting to see people think it may be greed.
Prices are rising fast, which gives consumers whiplash, says Johnson. And they've been rising over a long period, says Joel Rampolt at Alex Partners.
Inflation is cumulative, and the effects are not being fully felt yet.
He says we're at an inflection point where retailers may need to court consumers more heavily, though they may be wary of overcorrecting, says Barbara Kahn at the Wharton School. Running too many promotions can condition consumers to expect them forever.
And if they don't have a discount, then they feel like they're being ripped off.
Not to mention that sale item could be stuck on a container ship out in the Pacific Ocean. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The new CEO of Twitter, Parag Agrawal, he and his wife are about to have a baby. And Mr. Agrawal said this week he is going to take a few weeks of parental leave when the time comes. There has been, shall we say, a whole lot of reaction to that. Some of it positive that Agrawal taking family leave sets a good example for other new fathers, especially in Silicon Valley. Some less positive reactions to why only a few weeks, people ask, when Twitter offers 20 weeks of parental leave. And then, of course, see also Silicon Valley, there are those asking why he's taken parental leave at all. As Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, policies and attitudes around paternity leave, oh, they are changing.
Before Ryan Cooney told his boss that he and his wife were expecting a baby, he didn't think he'd have the option to take much time away from work.
I figured I'd get a few weeks off and that would be it.
Cooney's a high school teacher in Helena, Montana. And when he learned he could take up to 3 months off,
I was elated. I had no hesitation at all, but I faced some negativity from other men, specifically older men, guys who kind of rolled their eyes and said, "What, guys take paternity leave? That's a thing."
It's still pretty rare for men to take parental leave.
The vast majority of men don't have the option of taking paid time when a child is born.
Vicky Shabo is a fellow at the think tank New America. She says the majority of parents, period, don't get paid time off when they have or adopt a child. Less than a quarter even have the option. But that number is lower for men.
Paid paternity leave is only available to 13% of all employees in companies in the U.S., 13%.
It is becoming more common, slowly, for companies to offer paid leave to all parents, regardless of gender, and for men to take it, especially in higher paid fields like tech.
Men are starting to realize that being a much more engaged parent is important for them.
Brad Harrington at the Center for Work and Family at Boston College says it makes a difference when high profile people take parental leave.
It doesn't take that many people to take this leave to send a strong signal that you can do it and there is no stigma attached to it.
In Helena, Montana, Ryan Cooney doesn't know many other men who've taken paternity leave, but he's become an evangelist for it.
I just feel so much more positive and more confident and more prepared to be able to be the dad I need to be.
And he says he wishes all parents had that same chance. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's a one-woman show at the moment.
Got to start somewhere, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 232 today. That's about 0.7%, 34,079. The NASDAQ dropped 168 points. That is 1.2%, 13,548. The S&P 500 down 31 points, 0.7%, 43.48. Generally calm, though, as I said. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.9%, NASDAQ down 1.8%, the S&P 500 off 1.6%. Walmart, we were talking about that. Strong earnings despite those rollbacks, lost 0.6% today. Target gained 0.2%. Best Buy down about 0.9%. Bond prices were up, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.92%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of weeks ago, right at the end of the show, I think it was, this happened. Amazon reported earnings after the bell today. Top line revenue, that is before expenses, basically. And it occurs to me we should do an explainer on EBITDA, but that's a whole different thing. All right, well, promises made, promises kept, huh? EBITDA, however you want to say it. It's an acronym, Earnings Before Interest, Taxes, Depreciation, and Amortization. It's a way of looking at a company's earnings without taking interest and taxes and all that other stuff into account.
When you're looking at EBITDA, you get a better sense of a company's profitability.
Leila Peyravens, an assistant accounting professor at Rice University's Graduate School of Business.
So imagine that you're a pencil company.
Pencils? All right, pencils. I can work with that. For that pencil company, earnings would be all revenues minus every expense.
For example, your rent expense, your wage expense includes things like taxes that a company pays. It includes the interest that they pay on their debt.
Every expense, all of that stuff goes to bottom line earnings, net income in accountant speak. Now, to get to EBITDA, you get to ignore some of those line items like income taxes and interest expenses, or the declining value of machinery. That's depreciation, right? And ta-da, you got EBITDA. In theory, EBITDA helps analysts compare our pencil company to another pencil company. That other company might have sold the same number of pencils and had similar costs, but maybe they financed those costs with a bigger loan, or they set up shop in a state with lower taxes. All of that affects their income, but doesn't really have all that much to do with making pencils.
So EBITDA is a very common metric that is very pervasively used. However, there is not a clear agreement on how it's being used and why it's being used.
Patrick Badalato is at the University of Texas School of Business.
So why do we have a variety of financial metrics? Well, we're trying to understand company performance. But what's the best way to do that? Well, there isn't one. And there's flaws of every approach.
Take Amazon. A huge chunk of its earnings last quarter, nearly $12 billion, came in from an investment in Rivian, the oh-so-hot new electric car company that went public last November.
It's not really related to their core business of AWS and an online marketplace and all the other things that Amazon's doing. The gain from Rivian did happen, but it's clearly not something that's going to be a recurring part of their core business.
So if you're some Wall Street analyst or armchair stock picker, for that matter, trying to figure out how Amazon's really doing, you could look at the bottom line, net income, or you could calculate EBITDA. The main thing you got to know, though, is that neither one of those two is the whole picture.
We latch on to financial metrics because they seem to tell a nice and neat and tidy story. And the reality is messy and nuanced.
As we tell you all the time, when it comes to Amazon or that pencil company or the whole American economy, context is everything. Patrick Badalato at UT Austin and Leila Peyravens at Rice University helped us out with that. We do appreciate it. So it's possible As Neela and Jordan and I were talking about, that the virus might not be in charge of this economy anymore, and that life might, emphasis on the might, be getting closer to normal. Not the before times normal, but a place where COVID is just here and we live with it. Vaccines have a lot, almost everything to do with that, but access to those vaccines depends a whole lot on where you live. In some of the poorest countries on the planet, just 1 in 10 people has gotten at least one dose of vaccine. The global average is 62%. A new initiative from the World Health Organization, though, aims to change that, as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports.
The World Health Organization has picked a half dozen African nations to get the technology needed to produce a reverse-engineered version of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccine without the support of Moderna and Pfizer. Taher Amin is executive director of the Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge, a global nonprofit.
I think it's a huge announcement. It shows that the ability for others to make mRNA technology is there.
But some question whether these countries can build the infrastructure needed. Carrie Chan with Colombia's Healthcare and Pharmaceutical Management Program says the mRNA vaccine is more than the sum of its parts.
It has fairly stringent requirements with temperature and procedure. And so just having the recipe is not enough.
Chan says it takes partners with know-how to produce the vaccine at scale. Without them,
I think the uptake is going to be slow in large part because it's going to take time to build up the capabilities to have this large production.
Moderna declined to comment on whether it plans to support the World Health Organization initiative in any way. Pfizer didn't respond to Marketplace's inquiry. Advocates continue to push for the vaccine makers to fully share their valuable IP. Tim Kehoe, who teaches economics at the University of Minnesota, says the WHO's initiative is an important step if the global economy is going to recover from the pandemic.
We're hoping we're going to have a future in which the pandemic isn't running the world. And to do that, we got to get the world vaccinated.
Currently, Africa produces just 1% of all COVID-19 vaccines. Kehoe says the sooner the WHO initiative can get going, the better. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
We've heard all kinds of stories for the past, 6 months, maybe a year, of people changing things up in their professional lives, changing jobs, changing places, looking for better pay, better work-life balance, or maybe they just wanted to follow their passions. In today's installment of our series, My Economy, someone who made a change to make a difference.
My name is Alexandra Farber. I am a dancer, a visual artist, and a choreographer. It's hard for me to remember a time when dance wasn't a part of the picture. You know, you learn how to walk, you learn how to talk. And for me, in those first formative years, at 3 years old, I learned how to dance. Of course, as a dancer, you know you're going to retire from your performance career before, you know, an actual retirement age. So you have to have in mind what the next steps are going to be. Pre-pandemic, I always sort of thought about, well, after I'm done with my stage career, I would love to stay in the ballet world and perhaps become a repetiteur, which is someone who helps a choreographer, the people who create the dance, to set their work. When I was young, I loved choreography so much. And somewhere along the line, it kind of, you know, fell to the wayside, and I kind of wondered, you know, when we had lots of time during the pandemic, like, where did the repetiteur thoughts come in and where did the choreography thoughts leave? And it kind of became a big question about representation. Almost 100% of the people who came in as repetiteurs were women, but basically 100% of the choreographers who came in were men. And just sort of coming to those realizations made me go, okay, I need to start finding opportunities to give this a shot again as the choreographer. So I'm hoping in the future to see more and more women, and I'm Jewish as well, so there's really none of us. So I want to see more, and I think if you want to see it, you kind of have to be a part of it. There are definitely a lot of challenges starting out, particularly because I'm definitely doing this. It's a one-woman show at the moment. So when it comes to, you know, finding dancers, making a schedule, finding someone to do the costumes, dance is a super, super important part of who I am as a person and an artist. I have loved choreography from the very beginning, and it used to be something me and my friends got together and just did in my basement. And I'm really glad that I finally returned to doing that on a professional scale.
Alexandra Farber, a dancer, now a choreographer as well in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, we cannot do this without you, whatever it is that you do. So please tell us what's going on in your economy, would you? Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, news from the Federal Reserve, which is not eager to deal with another stock and securities trading scandal like they had late last year. We told you all about that. The Federal Open Market Committee, that's the biggie, the one that sets interest rates, they approved rules today that, among other things, banned senior Fed officials from buying individual stocks and individual bonds and cryptocurrencies and commodities or foreign currencies. They are not allowed to enter into derivatives contracts or short sales or buying anything on margin. Also, no buying and selling during periods of heightened financial market stress. Now, about those trading and investing rules for Congress. All right, we're out of here, but not without your moment of economic context. Apple announced today its new iOS update is going to let people unlock their phones with Face ID even when they have a mask on, which is great, super convenient. But it's been 2 years, and mask mandates are, you know, what took them? Anyway, that's it. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassid is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.